This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today we're going to honor the memory of John Spencer, who died a week ago of a sudden heart attack at the age of 58. His character on NBC's The West Wing, former White House Chief of Staff and current vice presidential nominee Leo McGarry, ironically had suffered a heart attack on the show last season. Leo recuperated. John Spencer, the man who brought the lovable Leo to life, did not. Spencer's great strength as an actor in portraying Leo was to convey, all at the same time, a sense of intelligence, a sense of urgency, and a definite sense of humor. On the page, many of his lines, especially the ones written by series creator Aaron Sorkin, may have looked almost minimalistic. But like the dialogue of David Mamet, The West Wing has a definite musical rhythm to its speech. And John Spencer was a virtuoso at hitting all the right notes. Here he is talking to Josh, played by Bradley Whitford, in one of those familiar scenes where the characters trade lines while marching briskly through the White House corridors. In backstage West Wing lingo, these are called walk-and-talk scenes, and Spencer was brilliant in them.
You wanted me?
Yeah, it's all set up.
The meeting?
Yeah.
This is great. Good is going to come from this.
Maybe.
Maybe, yeah, but how often do you get to...
Yeah.
When's the meeting?
Day after tomorrow.
You're kidding.
No.
Perfect.
We wanted to do it right away.
Yeah.
What's the problem?
Nothing.
What's the problem?
There's a woman I've been...
Amy Gardner.
Yeah.
I hear things.
I know.
I try to forget them quickly, but...
We were supposed to... This is ridiculous, but we were supposed to go away.
Where?
It doesn't matter. We've been having trouble getting together. Day after tomorrow?
Go.
I can't.
Go.
I need a beer for this.
No, you don't.
Don't worry about it.
My wife lives in my house. I live in a hotel. And this is why.
Yeah, okay.
John Spencer won an Emmy for his role as Leo. He also co-starred on L.A. Law and made his first movie appearance in War Games. As a teenager, he was featured on The Patty Duke Show as British cousin Kathy's boyfriend. He acted often on stage, and his other film roles included Presumed Innocent and The Rock. Terry spoke to John Spencer in April of 2000.
Let me ask you about something that happened in a recent episode. Mm-hmm. Your character is a former alcoholic.
That's right.
Who hasn't touched a drink for several years. I forget
right.
how many.
Eight.
Recently, the fact that he had been to a rehab center was made public by a kind of new aide in the White House. So mm-hmm. someone who is very young and very new to this kind of job. Was she an intern?
She was an intern.
Yeah, she
worked,
an intern. Okay.
Yeah, she worked in the administration office. She really didn't work in the West Wing itself. She was in administration, but that gave her privy to files.
Well, so she secretly makes this file public, you know, that you were in rehab.
She leaked it to a friend socially.
Yeah.
And who was in the opposite political party, and he took the football and ran with it.
When the story is traced back to the intern, she's fired. She comes into your office. Because you've mm-hmm. invited her in,
mm-hmm.
you talk it through, and then you tell her to keep her job.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Being in recovery myself for 10 years, I kind of have an intimacy with the rooms, with AA. And one of the precepts of the program is forgiveness and lack of proselytizing. Share your story. Don't do inventory on other people's points of view. Love and forgive constantly. And I think the turning point for Leo, which I had to find as an actor, I think is a conversation. He plans to fire her. He asks her why she's done this. And in questioning why she did this, when she comes out with the fact that her father was an alcoholic and his irrationality and strange behavior was so aberrant to her, so horrifying, that this was the only other alcoholic she knew. And suddenly finding out that the chief of staff of the White House of the United States was also an alcoholic, her only point of reference was her old man, was her dad. And as she expresses that, I think myself as Leo have to realize, well, the motivation is a positive one. The result might have been horrible for me, and for my friend the president, and for our administration. But this woman, it was not kind of nasty, you know, water cooler gossip. It was someone who really feared that it would could be very dangerous, and to have a man with this weakness or this problem in this important position. And when I see that, and I kind of note that she has a love of the government and a love of its responsibility, feeling that she was well motivated, I think I have to give her a second chance. And God knows my character's been given through his life a lot of second chances. So how can you get and not give, you know?
Was the chief of staff character originally written as a recovering alcoholic, or was that aspect of his character written in after you got the part because of your own experience?
Yeah, good question, and often asked me. The truth of the matter is, it was not originally written that way. I have since, because I've been asked this question so many times, gone to Aaron and said, listen, how much did my life influence you there? Because we've talked very rarely about it. I mean, I remember one time going into the soundstage, and I was yet struggling again with the cigarette, no cigarette thing. And we were talking about addiction, and I said, well, this is the last threshold for me, and this is the hardest. And then I started talking about being in recovery. And I don't know if he knew about it before then or not, but it was a very light, casual conversation. And since the episodes have aired that cover this, I've been asked that question a lot because I'm not anonymous, and people know that I'm in recovery. So it seems like the obvious question. So I went to Aaron and I asked him if my life influenced his desire to put the character that way. And he said, absolutely not. He said, you know, it was part of his creative imagination, part of his own life experience, knowing people in recovery. And I triggered it off by saying I was in recovery, but he was not basing it on my life.
In TV, you're best known for your roles on L.A. Law and mm-hmm. The West Wing. But your first recurring TV role was on The Patty Duke Show.
It certainly was.
As Kathy's boyfriend, the British identical cousin.
The British identical cousin, I forget, what was the role called? Henry Anderson, I think, was the guy's name.
You don't even remember.
Well, I was 16. I'm 53 now, so it was a while ago. Yeah. Well, what a lucky stroke. It was one of the first jobs I ever did in the show business. And I guess there was something in my personality that they thought suited that character, and they just hired the man to play the character the way they wanted, and that's what they got.
Why don't you refresh your memory and describe the character?
I was kind of goofy. It was, kind of a typical teenager in the 60s. I watch some of the reruns every once in a while, and I look particularly tall and skinny to myself with very big ears and kind of voice that cracked as it got up in the higher register. So it's almost at times if I see that, like I'm watching a different person, you know?
Were you in it from the first episode, or was the character written in later?
It was recurring. I was in the first episode, and I say I would maybe did 10 or 15 of the 22 of the first two seasons. And then the show moved to California because Patty turned 18, and it was working codes and things. She was not under the child labor law any longer, so they could easily do the show in California. And they didn't take any of the recurring people with them to California. So I was only on the first two seasons.
Did she get a new boyfriend?
Kathy? Kathy kind of played the field, as I remember.
She was such a swinger. No, she wasn't.
No, she wasn't. The other one was. Do you remember the theme song?
Oh, of course.
Yeah, I do too.
Why don't you sing it? I'm not going to.
I can't sing it. I won't go near that. But it's amazing how many people do.
Now, when you were in high school when you got the role?
I was.
Well, could you walk down the halls of your high school without people singing the song to you?
Well, at that point, when I was about 16, I left my New Jersey home and moved into New York City, much to my parents' chagrin. And God bless them for ultimately letting me do this, as petrified as it must have made them. Now, as a 53-year-old man, I look back and realize the horror I must have put them through. And I was pretty rebellious, and I was pretty sure of what I wanted to do. I knew by 8 years old that I wanted to act. Why? Don't ask me. It just seemed a certainty for me in my mind. So I went into New York, and I didn't know the first thing about anything, let alone how to break into this elusive business that I wanted to be a part of. So I got a job as a I wasn't a waiter. They couldn't hire me as a waiter because I was too young and I didn't have working papers. So I was a busboy, and then I found out when the summer was over that I had to go to school if I wanted to work, because I had to get things called working papers, and I needed that up to the point that I was 18. So begrudgingly, I sought out to go back to high school. I thought, you know, 16, you can leave high school. I'll just never see school again. I mean, that's how intelligent I was at that point. And so I enrolled in this high school called Professional Children's School. Not like the Fame High School, the high school portrayed in Fame, which was called the School of the Performing Arts. We were not taught craft things. We were not taught singing, dancing, acting. It was just academics, but it was academics for children, teenagers, high school students, who had working lives. I was in school with Pinchas Zukerman, who at that time was a concert violinist, has since become a very famous conductor. Famous ice skaters, ballet dancers, all of the New York City Ballet was in that school. Actors, we had some rock singers. It was a very eclectic mix of teenagers.
So your circle at the high school included ballet dancers, a soon-to-be famous classical musician.
Liza Minnelli, Jennifer O'Neill.
So where in the ranking of everybody's aspirations was being on the Patty Duke Show? Was that seen as like having really made it and great work, or did people look down on that? Like, where did that fit?
No, we were, it's a very interesting thing. I think first and foremost, we were teenagers. We were very concerned with what girl was wearing what and how she looked and who we wanted to date and, you know, cutting school and all the things that teenagers did, except that we had this other life in the workplace. It was not, there was no condescension concerning that. It was, oh my God, you got a gig, how great. You know, these little teenagers with a sort of professional actor outlook of, oh my God, I got the job.
For a lot of people who grew up with the Patty Duke Show, they probably thought that, like, one day they'd be old enough to go to the malt shop with a date.
Oh, I know.
And, I mean, did the whole idea of what being a teenager was on the Patty Duke Show affect your idea of what it meant to be a teenager?
We were kind of different teenagers, a little more jaded, a little more worldly wise, a little more out there, because we had no time to go to the malt shops. We were either at the studio or trying to make up homework.
I'm not sure you could have found a malt shop like that in Manhattan.
We had a place called Rudley's, which was right by the school. It was a coffee shop. No longer there. The Gulf Western building is there now. And we would often, I'm talking out of school here, Terry. We would often cut classes and hang out there and drink Coca-Colas and eat English muffins and smoke cigarettes, a habit that I picked up early on and I'm still trying to get rid of.
It's hard. It is really hard.
Oh, boy. It seems to me my Achilles heel. This is now my third attempt. I stopped for 18 weeks and then very cavalierly over Christmas decided, okay, I'm strong. I'll have a few cigarettes. I'm on vacation. Well, there was a really stupid point of view because within 3 or 4 days I was smoking completely again.
So you're trying to stop again?
I've just been hypnotized. That was not the greatest tool, so I'm going to go back to the patch and Zyban, which I used and kept me free for 18 weeks. Actually, I used them for 12, and 6 weeks I was totally clean. So well, I know that to work, so I'm going to try that again.
Your character on West Wing doesn't smoke, does he?
Not at all.
That's good, because you wouldn't have to smoke. You wouldn't.
No, I
that would
made
really
that
hurt
as
to
a,
have to smoke to be in character.
Absolutely. I made that as a conscious choice. Also, the White House is a smoke-free area.
Of course.
So we'd have to run outside to have one. Do you smoke?
Oh, I gave it up a long time ago.
How'd you do that? Cold turkey, or did you use tools?
Well, I'll tell you what happened to me. I lost my voice twice on the air because I had a cold and I was smoking right through it.
Yeah.
And I realized, you know, this is going to be really awful if I lose my voice again like this. So that it definitely inspired me to stop. And I didn't. I just stopped.
You did.
Yeah, I mean, I was sick when I stopped. I had a really bad cold, no voice, so it was easy to get through that. and then keep going. But I had stopped, you know, an amazing number of times before that and started again.
It's a squirrely habit. It really gets you.
It really
does. If I had to do it again, one of the regrets in my life is ever starting. And I remember my father, I was 15. We were in an airport, and I was running to get something, and I gave him my coat to hold. And I came back, and his demeanor had totally changed, and he had obviously gone in my pocket and found this pack of cigarettes.
Yeah.
And we had this huge fight in the airport, I remember. And, of course, nothing he said meant anything to me. He was an old man with no knowledge of what I was going through. And I remember his words ingrained in my mind today of, you will regret this day, John, believe me. You will come to the point where you will wish you had never done this. And he was right. Father knows best.
There's some actors who did some pretty great bits of business with cigarettes. You know, Humphrey Bogart, Lauren Bacall. I mean,
absolutely.
You just you remember how they looked when they smoked. When you were starting acting and smoking, was a cigarette a really good prop for you?
Absolutely. I taught myself. I stood in front of a mirror in the upstairs bathroom and taught myself to smoke. I smoked and I thought, this doesn't look right. This doesn't look like other people. And so, you know, I kind of did that, holding them with the first three fingers.
Oh,
know,
yes,
that kinda
right.
Tough look.
Yeah.
And then I thought, it still doesn't look right. And I realized I wasn't inhaling. I didn't know what inhaling was. So why isn't it coming out of my nose? And I took a deep breath, and it came out of my nose. The room started spinning around. I was sick on the bed. And the next day, I started again. And with enough practice, I learned how.
Do you have a favorite smoking scene from your movies?
From my movies? Let me think. Not really, but I loved the concept that David Kelly wrote, my first episode of L.A. Law. Melania was a smoker, and they often let me smoke on that show. I believe after a while, the character became very popular, and NBC got very worried that I was a good guy smoking, and there was some pressure from the network that I shouldn't smoke on the show. But that came the second and third season. The first season, I smoked like a fiend. In fact, there was one scene I remember where Leland McKenzie, Richard Dysart, walked in my, opened the door, and like smoke poured out of my office. But my first litigation, my first case was a secondary smoke suit, where I got the client millions of dollars and attacked the cigarette companies, where in between scenes I was smoking like a wild thing. And I loved that dynamic. I thought that was so great and so David Kelly, that kind of, complex situation.
You know, it's funny, a lot of actresses complain that when they hit their 40s, the roles dry up. Your career really took off in your 40s and 50s.
Absolutely.
And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about why that is.
I do. I was a character actor in a young man's body. I don't think people knew what to do with me in my 20s. You know, because I wasn't Matt Dillon, or I wasn't your typical young leading man. Yet I also wasn't so much of a character actor that, you know, I could play the occasional really offbeat sidekick. I fell somewhere in the middle, and therefore in the cracks. As my face began to age and more meet the roles, things got better and better. I'm one of those examples of it getting better and better with time. The older I got, the better it got. And I think that's because of the character actor syndrome. Really, it's very hard for the industry to find what to do with young character actors. Men, bad enough. Women, almost impossible. And so we have to wait it out, you know, which is a hard dynamic. But my real view about acting is, unless you need it like an opiate, unless you really, I mean, you jones for it, you can't live without it, I would do something else. There are so many other things that are easier on the soul, more lucrative, more steady. But if you need your art and it's undeniable to you, then you don't have a choice. That's why when young actors ask me, do I think they should act? I say no, because unless they know they have to act, I don't think it's worth it. It's hard enough when it's going well. If it's not going well, it's impossible.
John Spencer, speaking to Terry Gross in the year 2000. He won an Emmy for his role as Leo McGarry on The West Wing in 2002 and died last Friday of a heart attack.